Hello, everyone, and welcome again to another episode of the Adani Podcast. Today, we're here again with Mark Abramovich, founder of Mears Group Lending Organization. And in this episode, you're going to learn how to analyze a multifamily and single family deal. By the end of this episode, you're going to be an expert on how to analyze income, expenses, and you'll be able to see if these deals are a good investment for you or not. So whether this is your first time investing in a deal or you're a longtime expert investor, there's something to learn in this episode, and we'll go over, you know, all the factors that we need to get in place to know if a deal is good or not. So why should you listen to us? Mark and I have both been investing in real estate for a while. I'd say over 10 to 15 years now. We've seen multiple cycles, and we've seen the ups and downs. I'm sure both of us have made money, lost money on real estate deals. So you know, we're seasoned. Mark, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your analysis and investing journey?
Sure. So, as I mentioned last time, I started in 2003 in the, you know, mountains of the in the Pocono Mountains in Pennsylvania with trailers. And at the time, I didn't know anything, actually. We didn't know about lock boxes, key codes. You know, I made the mistake of having to drive up when we would have renters. I would drive up from New York. So for those of you who don't know, that's a 5-hour round trip just to let people in and out. And I realized that we were done when I avoided renting to someone just so I wouldn't have to make that round trip. So from there, you know, we got out, and actually between, you know, how much we sold the properties for and, you know, deductions and all of that, you know, we didn't lose money. I think we broke even, maybe even came out ahead a little bit. But from there, we got into a real estate education company, right? So as I mentioned, Craig and I were working together. And so the order, the chronology was, you know, actually, I think it'd be a good place to tell everybody how you and I started working together.
So, sure. Let's go ahead.
You know, there was a coworker of ours that I would that I knew was investing in real estate. And I kept telling him, hey, Morgan, you know, can I do real estate with you? Can I invest in real estate with you? Can I invest in real estate with you? And at the time, you know, green was not the way to describe me. I mean, greener than green. And until one day Morgan said, why don't you go talk to Craig? You know, and he said, you know, I'm doing deals with my friends. You know, at the time he dropped the term on me, I didn't even understand, which was syndicating deals. So he said, I'm syndicating deals with my friends. You know, we're not looking for any new investors, but why don't you go talk to Craig? I said, what does Craig do? And he said, why don't you go talk to Craig? I said, okay. And I walked into Craig's office, right? I walked into your office and I basically said, what are you doing with real estate in Connecticut? That's what Morgan told me. And Craig's response at the time was, what? Who are you and why are you asking me? But you know, but that's essentially where our conversation began. And the reason why I think, you know, everybody should take note of this is you never know where life will take you and what opportunities come out of a conversation, right? I walked into Craig's office and said, hey, what are you doing with real estate? This was back in 2014, 2015. And here we are essentially 7 years later, running a company together, you know, and having been doing business since. Okay. We own property together. We own a management company together. So all of it started with one question of, hey, what are you doing? So fast, you know, and Craig can give you guys his perspective on it afterwards. But we, you know, and essentially we started from there. We bought a building together, and it was only after that that my wife stumbled onto a real estate education company called Fortune Builders. And we went to their free, turned into 2 years and then some. We went to their 2-hour free presentation, and where they, you know, they sell a 3-day for a few hundred dollars, which was worth it. We went to that. And from there, we signed up for their education and membership, you know, join Fortune Builders, right?
Right. Even from there, we took a few courses together. I remember the rental property intensive, and that had a bit of analyzing, you know, multifamily deals, what to look for. And also the Commercial Academy, too, was pretty good because they broke down some of the numbers and how to look at the deal from value add perspective or, you know, potential flip perspective. So that was a really good training on how to do this. And I'll just speak to my side, you know, talking to, you know, I'm the founder of Idani Management, a property management company. Not only have I invested in my own real estate deals in Connecticut, but I've also seen a lot of owners who come to us to manage property. And we see their numbers that we bring, we see their analysis, and sometimes they have cash cows that generate, you know, passive income every month. And we also get the deals where there's no money at the end of the month because the expenses are too high and they bought at a price that was too high. So we've seen, you know, we've seen all of it. And we're here today to break down really what goes into analyzing a deal. So, you know, you don't get stuck with a deal that doesn't make any money. I mean, I would say 90% of the deals out there don't make money, and you really have to do your analysis to figure out which deals do, so you can separate the wheat from the chaff. So, So Mark, why don't we jump in and
let's jump in.
What do you think the first step is if an investor, they get a deal from their agent says, hey, this is a great deal, you know, cash cow, you know, you should buy it immediately. What should a new investor do to as the first step to analyze this deal?
So the first step, it doesn't matter if it's a new investor or a seasoned investor. Actually, the first step is exactly the same. You run your own analysis. You run your own analysis and underwriting. And the reason why I break out those two words separately is, in my opinion, analysis is story and underwriting is math. Okay. So first you look at the story of the building. And what I mean by that is who's going to manage it, right? How much are you buying it for? Where is it? Is it close to you or is it some distant city or state where you're not going to be able to get there and you're going to need a property manager to take care of it, right? Who is going to property manage it for you? Even if it is local to you, right? Who's the property manager? Is it going to be you self-managing or is it going to be a third-party property manager you're paying to take care of it, okay? This is all part of the story and we'll go through the story a little bit more in more detail. Now, underwriting is putting numbers to that story, okay? So for example, if we're gonna say that a property manager is managing, well, how much are they charging, right? That's actually putting numbers to it. And the first thing is, right, so for whether you're a seasoned investor, whether you're brand new, the first step is to run this analysis and underwriting. And I mentioned on the last call, you know, people can visit mearsgroupllc.com and download our, you know, /underwriter and download the exact deal underwriter that I use for our own deals, right? It's no different. I use the exact same spreadsheet that's available for everybody's download. So getting back to it. So tell the story, right? Is it you managing yourself or are you hiring a third party manager? Okay. Now I will suggest that even if you're going to self-manage, put something into the spreadsheet for the fee so that you can get paid, right? You should be getting paid for the work you do. And on the other hand, let's say something happens to you and you do need to give it up for third party management afterwards. Well, at least you have it in the budget now to do so. So you need to know management fees. You need to know the property taxes. You need to know the insurance cost, right? There's property insurance on this. You're going to want, you know, every year you're going to be filing taxes. This is typically something people don't account for, right? Filing taxes is, you know, a few hundred dollars, but you still need to do it. So that's part of your expenses. Then you've got management of the LLC. So typically, how to buy a property. You can either buy it in your personal name, or you can buy it into a container such as a limited liability company so that you're separated from liability on it, so that there's a separation, right? It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to an LLC, and you're an officer in that LLC. And now there's a separation of liability and, you know, responsibility. You know, that's a whole separate conversation. Mm-hmm. But my point is that somebody's running that LLC. Okay. So even when you own it in an LLC, somebody is running it, and it's separate from the management of the property, right? A property management company manages the property, but somebody has to manage that management company. Somebody has to talk to an accountant. Somebody has to talk to, the tax preparer. Those functions are part of running the asset, running the LLC if it's inside of an LLC. So that's separate. So
now, Mark, where would someone get an estimate for this number? So let's say I'm brand new. I want to do property management. I don't know who's going to manage it yet, but I want to get this deal. Are there some starting numbers we should put in just to get an idea of that could give us a realistic view on this deal, even if I don't know the exact numbers?
Yes. So the number that you can put in is 10% for the management. That's kind of across the industry. It's more or less the standard. You're going to come across and look, it's what we charge at Edani. So our fee is 10% manage of the income coming in is our fee, right? 10% of the income plus 1 month of as a lease up fee. Okay, so if you were to put that actually, if you consider how long a tenant typically stays and you were to break up that 1 month's rent also over, the 2 to 3 years that a tenant stays, that gives you another, let's say about 3% per month to put into that management fee, right? How much you're losing out of the incoming rent to management. So now different companies have different fee structures. Some will charge less as a management fee, but they will have other fees, right?
Whether so we're just looking for a basic number ballpark, to put in there, right. Ballpark.
But I think
we can get an idea because we're going to be analyzing a lot more deals than we actually do. So we want a quick rough view. Yeah,
I think 10 to 14% management fee, like 10% management fee in the spread in the analyzer, I think is a good number. I wanted to expand on what the different fees are and how, it could be a very big number in terms of percentage, but if there's no additional fees, it may work out better than a small management fee and a bunch of little fees being tacked on. Okay. Right. So you have to be aware of it. And when you're dealing with a property manager, you want to ask them what are your fees, right? What's your fee structure? So a good beginning point, 10% management. Another number to look out for is vacancy, right? So the property is going to be vacant. It's either going to be physically vacant or economically vacant. And the difference is physical vacancy is nobody's living there. The tenants that were there, they needed to move cities. They left. Now you need to tenant it up. It's vacant. There's no rent coming in. The other kind of vacancy, or let's say the tenants weren't paying and they were evicted. Still, there's nobody there. So physically, it is empty. The other kind of vacancy is economic vacancy, which means somebody's living there and they're not paying. Now, this may be because they're waiting for something. Maybe they're not paying and they're in the process of being evicted, but they're still not paying. So now the property is occupied, but it's not collecting rent. That's an economic vacancy. To some extent, this could be even worse because at least a physical vacancy, you can fill it and move on, right? You've got rent coming in again. With an economic one, it's kind of an indefinite, you're not collecting rent.
All right. Could be unknown. Correct. How long that might last. You might be going through an eviction. You might be going through,
right.
Sorry to say, COVID. I don't want to say the word until we get
right.
Banned or
government
anything,
said I don't have to pay.
There were periods in time where we almost couldn't do anything.
Right.
With economic vacancy. So yeah, that's a good ballpark number. you would add
for vacancy for that. So interesting. It used to be, it depends. So on the one hand, it depends on the market. But these days, pretty much housing is, there's a shortage of housing. So right now, 3 to 5% is what you would put in for vacancy. That's a good number.
So we're and, so we got 10% for management, 3.3 to 5% for vacancy.
For vacancy. Okay. Right. Now, let's get to some interesting stuff. So we talked about property taxes and insurance. And it's actually really funny. You mentioned the dirty C word. And at the time, you know, when government said, oh, you know, it's okay. You don't have to pay your rent if you've got difficulties. You know, somehow they forgot to tell landlords they don't have to pay their property taxes. For some reason, that bill was still due.
Just keep
it in mind, right? So we get to reserves for maintenance and repairs and CapEx reserves. Okay. And this is where you may, you know, you might want to go less, or you might just in case go higher on the reserves, just in case of unforeseen circumstances like this. And what's interesting is, you know, when, you know, COVID came, for example, you and I on the properties that we own, we've always run a little bit more conservative on reserves. We run at about 10% reserves. At least that's the way we initially bought the properties years ago. So that's never changed. So we put aside 10% of the monthly rent in reserves for repairs, capital expenses, and any kind of unforeseen circumstances. So when COVID came, guess what? We were still paying property taxes and insurance, and we never had to do a capital call. As in, never did Craig and myself and other partners we have involved, did we have to get on the phone and say, okay, you know what? We're short on money. We're actually going to have to put money in instead of taking money out as cash flow and income. So that's because we run very conservative on reserves for repairs. So let's talk about those reserves and what they're for. There are two kinds of repairs that are going to happen. There is the, you know, things break. Right. Toilet gets clogged. It's more, and we're not going to discuss right now what's on the what's the tenant's responsibility and what's the landlord's. Let's just say something breaks, right? Wear and tear on the building. Handrail gets, you know, knocked down out of the wall. You know, multifamily building, right? Handrail gets broken. We need to replace it. This is a bill that needs to get paid. It was unexpected. It's not a, it doesn't add or detract value from the building. Right? But it needs to get done. Surprise. So this is part of the repairs, right? The kind of like the day-to-day, year-to-year repairs that need to be accounted for. Now, how much is it going to be? We don't know, but this is part of those repairs. Now, then there's what's known as capital expenses, capital expenditures, right? Which is roof, furnace, central AC, right? Big ticket items that get replaced every 15 to 25 years, and they're going to happen. Now, the question becomes, and this is kind of on each owner, the, you know, individually, whether they're going to set aside money every month, or do they just expect that, you know what, when the time comes for me to replace the roof, I'm going to refinance the property, pull the equity that was built up in there, and I'm going to use the money, you know, use that money. It's a personal preference. In our case, the decision was we'll set aside money every month. And it served us well. I'll give you guys an example. The first building that Craig and I bought together was a 6-unit. We still own it. Okay. And by now, you know, I'm going to drop a term that we'll expand on later. It's called infinite return. By now, that building is infinite return, is an infinite return. We have no more money into that deal. Okay. Now, when Craig and I bought it, it's a 6-unit building. So obviously it was, you know, built in one shot. And obviously all of the appliances, all of the furnaces and, you know, heating units, everything was installed at the same time. So you would expect that with a similar life expectancy, things would break at the same time. So we bought the building, you know, everything was fine. And also I you know, again, I run conservative on reserves. So the day we bought it, we put 2 months of everything in, right, into reserve, whether it was the mortgage payments, common utilities, reserves, everything was in there. Day one, 2 months were set aside. All right, so we bought it, a few months went by, and then 3 water heaters died at the same time. Now, you know, I tell the story and some people go, oh my God, three water heaters at the same time. To me, with my engineering background, you know, it's actually, I was pleased, right? That's some consistency among hot water heaters. I'm going to figure that the hot water heaters were from the same manufacturer. The builder took them on the same day, put them in, right? So the fact that three of them died at the same time, you know, I was impressed. Now, my concern, I had no concern. It was an expected sooner or later item to be replaced. We replaced three water heaters and moved on with our lives. It didn't matter because we had the reserves. Now, going forward, we don't have to worry about those hot water heaters for the next 15 to 20 years. I'm hoping 15 to 20, right? That's more of a capital expense. Same thing, you know, we've had to replace and, you know, patch the roof and replace it along the way. So
what number would you put in for those and how would you split that up? Would you put that as one number in the spreadsheet or would you split that up into two?
All right. So I put it in as one number. Now, the number, it depends on the condition of the building, whether it was more renovated or a little older. I would say the number is anywhere between 6 and 10%.
Okay.
You get, I would say you figure 3% for day-to-day,
yeah.
3% for day-to-day, 3% for CapEx. And depending on the kind of wear and tear and where your building is, whether it's a little worse neighborhood and, you know, tenants who are going to be more abusive to it versus higher end neighborhood with tenants who are more careful, that just starts determining whether the wear, you know, you're running, you know, are you closer to 6% or are you climbing higher to 10?
All right. Okay. So we have taxes, we have insurance, we have yep. management, we have maintenance. Which we consider repairs and capital expenditures.
Yep.
What other expenses can you think of, Mark, that we should include in our analysis?
All right. So what are we including in our analysis? Like I mentioned before, somebody's filing taxes. That filing is going to be at least a few hundred dollars for the year. So you put that in. Now, part of your, you know, speaking of expenses, right? Whether it's repairs, maintenance, whether it's more or less. Let's look at landscaping, depending on the state. Okay. In hotter states, you're going to have landscaping such as grass cutting. Okay. That starts adding up, right? Well, if anybody who's listening is a homeowner, you know what it costs to cut your grass. So that number can be anywhere from $40 to $80 a month in landscaping. Now, the reason why we have to take it into account is it depends on whether it's a single family house or a multifamily. In single family houses, the tenants, because it's one house, the tenant is responsible for everything. Okay. In a multifamily house, the landlord is responsible for things like landscaping, common utilities, right? So if you have a multifamily building and you've got a hallway with lights in it, well, the landlord is responsible for that electric bill. Okay. In some older buildings, water is not split up. So water and sewer are on the landlord, not on the tenants. Now you can bill it back, but, you have to be cognizant of these bills, right? And again, you can put it in however you like, whether it's part of your, repairs and maintenance, or whether it's part of your, a separate line item for common utilities, right? Common utilities, landscaping, trash removal, right? In some cities, in some states, in some counties, the landlord may be paying for garbage removal. And if this starts happening, by the way, in a multifamily building, guess what? For that common utility bill, for that landscaping, that's an additional 5% that I would set aside. Okay.
Right.
And by the way, our listeners are probably starting to get the feel of the bill running up, right? 10% for management, 10% for repairs and, or at least 6%. So that's 16% right there. 5% for common utilities. That's 21% in overhead, right? Vacancy. So that's at 3% even. That's 24% right off the top, right? We haven't even gotten to property taxes and insurance. In some places, this could be a huge burden. Bridgeport, actually, for property taxes is a beast. We're talking about anywhere between a month and a half to 2 months. Think about it, to 2 months of rent being eaten up just by the property taxes. So
what about pest control? I know that's an expense that some multifamily owners are required to provide.
So I wouldn't, pest control, it depends on how much it is, right? So again, if you add it into, you know, $40 for cutting the grass, $30 for pest control per month, you know, so all of this is being, you know, tacked in. You can either have it as a separate line, like a literal dollar line item, or you could just have it as percentages. And you can have it as part of that 5% kind of maintenance number. Now, landscaping, again, this is where I want to be very, you know, distinguish between different states and what landlords have to deal with or management companies have to deal with as a thing to do and as an expense to deal with. So in hot states, you're going to have grass cutting, right? So that has to be going on year round. Well, guess what? In the Northeast or Northwest, in the North period, you have to deal with snow removal. Okay. Now, snow removal, that's a big issue because you don't want to deal with slip and fall. Places like New York City and, you know, let's say Connecticut, there are laws about when you have to remove snow. Anytime there is more than X amount of inches within 4 hours of the last snowflake falling, you have to clear the sidewalk and, you know, put salt on it, right? So every time it snows, you know, my wife is actually a partner in the management company with myself and Craig. And, you know, every time it snows in Connecticut, you know, she's running around the house screaming, "Oh my God, it's snowing again." And I laugh and I say, you know, living in Florida, it's kind of like, what do we care about snow in Connecticut? And every time she screams and goes, "I have to deal with snow removal." So, snow removal is an expense, right? And the more times it snows, the more that expense piles on. And we don't know what it's going to be. So you have to, that's part of your 6 to 10% of management, of maintenance slash repairs, whatever you want to file it under, right? So I would almost say, you're asking me, would I put different numbers? I would say break it up this way. 6% from repairs and maintenance, right? Repairs and kind of CapEx reserves. And then another 5% is your landscaping, you know, maintenance, common utilities bills. Now, obviously, if you're, the more data you collect, the more precise you'll be able to get with these numbers.
Right. Especially if you're in a market a long time and you're invested in that market and you know what those numbers are, you can kind of dial that in, you know, more.
Right.
Yeah.
So, these are all of the, I think we've pretty much covered all of the big items.
For property expenses. Yeah. Yeah. Let's roll into the income side of things. And let's say we have a deal and our agent sends us this deal. How do we determine what the income is and what do we put on our analysis sheet there?
So you're going to be putting in, you want to know what the rent roll every month is, right? So what are the rents collected? Now, in a building where the management before was iffy, right? The previous owner wasn't on the ball, or the property manager wasn't on the ball, and they weren't raising rents consistently over the years. There's definitely room to improve. Now, when that happens, the favorite tactic of every agent is to tell you how, you know, when you buy it, you can increase rents. And my answer has been over the years, Craig has heard me say it, is, you know, if it was so easy to raise rents, you would have done it. Mm-hmm. So you're paying based on what is. Now, could you look at potential growth and kind of maneuver a little bit? Yes, but you're buying based on what is, right? Because you buy the building and you know, or the house, the building, whatever it is. And if you find out that there were issues or there's a reason why the rent wasn't raised, you're now stuck with that incoming rent. So you want to know what the rental income is. In some multifamily houses or bigger buildings, you may have laundry machines. That's an additional income. You may have some kind of arrangement with the cable company where they're bringing cable in, you're paying the fee, and then you're splitting it amongst the tenants, right? So there might be some kind of bill back for that and some kind of potential income. But the main thing you want to know for income is, what is the gross rent? Right? Rent per apartment every single month, right? So when you're plugging in the numbers, you plug in your gross rent, you reduce it by the vacancy, whatever, 3 to 5% vacancy. That gives you your net rent coming in. And from there, you start deducting all of your expenses, right? You deduct your management fee, your reserves, your maintenance reserves or expenses, your whatever expenses there are, you start subtracting from it, including your mortgage payment.
Okay. So even let's take out the mortgage payment just yet.
Okay.
Let's say we have our income. Yep. We subtract our expenses from the property. That number we have left, let's say we bought the property cash, that would be our...
So the net income? Yeah.
That would be our net operating income, right?
Correct. There's your NOI.
So, now we choose, okay, are we going to finance this? Are we going to pay with cash?
Well.
And then we have an additional... Well, may have additional financing costs that we need to subtract there.
Well, hang on. Before you get to financing costs, because the financing cost will alter the deal significantly, okay? So it's going to muddy it up, right? When the cost of money is cheap, money is going to be positive leverage. It will increase the return. And today, cost of money is so expensive, it's actually decreasing it in some scenarios. So let's first stop here and say, if you were to buy this with cash, okay, your net income, you know, relative to your expense, that return, okay, that cash on cash return, right? You put in some cash and you're getting cash back. That percentage, what is it?
And how do you calculate? What's the formula for that?
Net operating income divided by purchase price. And you're going to end up with some kind of number. Okay.
Yeah.
That number is your return if this was a cash purchase.
Right.
Okay.
I think that's how we get the cap rate.
Correct.
That would be our cap rate number, which if we were purchasing in cash without leverage is what we would get. So now if we want to supercharge our return, we can borrow some money to buy this property.
Correct. But here's the beauty. Cash tells the truth. Okay. This is a very important point. Cash tells the truth because cash tells you whether this is a good deal or a bad deal in and of itself. Because leverage will adjust the numbers. It can take a bad, you know, positive leverage can take a bad deal and make it good, or it can take a good deal and make it bad. But in cash, you're going to determine whether this is a good deal. If the cash on cash return, if you were to buy it in cash and the cash on cash return is zero, I think we can all agree that's a bad deal. Okay. On the other hand, if, you know, back in the good old days when things were more stable, for example, you and I were looking at deals where the initial cash on cash we wanted was 10%. And then we were putting positive leverage on it because money was cheap, right? You're in my, the first loan you and I did was 6.75%, and it was still a positive leverage loan. What's funny is when we refinanced that property and we got a new loan on it, our interest rate is 4.5%. So it's massively positive. In essence, our 10% cash on cash, if we bought it with cash, is more like 12 to 15%, okay, on the money that we've put in.
And why is that? That's because we're not putting in the full purchase price. We're just putting the 10%, 25%, whatever the down payment is. So we have a lot less money in the deal.
Because we're making money on the bank's money.
Right.
Because essentially, so guys, you can follow along and do this. Just kind of look at it this way. If we're making 10% on the money put into the deal as cash, and let's say the bank gives us money at 5%. So we're making money on their money at 10%. We have to pay them 5% interest. So we've given up 5% to the bank, but we get to keep the additional 5% that gets added to the 10% that we're making on the down payment that we made.
Right.
That made sense, right?
Yep.
So bank provides 80%. We're putting in 20%. Okay. We're making 10% on our 20% and we're making 10% on the bank's 80%. The bank wants 5% on their 80%, right? That's if it's, you know, a 5% interest rate.
Yeah.
We're keeping the remaining 5% in addition to the 10% we're making on our 20. Okay. This is an example of positive leverage. We're making, you know, the cost of money, the interest rate on the money is less than what the return is. On the other hand, today it's a little bit upside down. Today, a lot of the deals that we find, that we find for sale are more like more of a 7 cap. They're a 7% return if you bought them for cash. And the cost of money from a bank today is 7.25 to 8.25 to hard money kind of being at 8.5%, right? So we're making 7% while paying 8.5% for money. This is why it's negative.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And in addition to, we have to take into account any of the loan origination costs and the closing costs and the additional overhead that the bank loan process would charge.
Correct. Which is all part of that overhead number of what did you spend to buy the property, right? That's what drives the number for what kind of cash on cash return you're seeing. It's the money in, whether it's cost of the bank loan cost or anything else versus what kind of net operating income you're getting. Okay. So, and finally, we get to that bottom line number, right? What kind of cash on cash return are we seeing after cost of money, after all the reserves, right? What kind of cash on cash return are you seeing? Now, as I said, today, right, we're seeing that 7 to 8% is kind of the cost, is kind of like what we're buying assets at, right? Where what a lot of my clients are buying assets at. So we're seeing 7 to 8%. So whatever it ends up being after financing is kind of where it shakes out, that 2 to 4% cash on cash return. And that's why I said you want to know the number in cash first to know whether it in and of itself, is it a good deal? And then you get financing for whatever you can get. Now, today money is expensive. Obviously, we're all hoping that in the next 2 to 3 years, interest rates will come back down. At which point an asset that was purchased today and it's only cash flowing 2 to 4%, the moment you refi and you go from, let's say, 8% cost of money down to 4% cost of money, that number increases immediately, right? From 2 to 4%, you're now bringing in 10-11% cash on cash return just by refinancing and paying less for the money. So that's the long-term idea now, right? It's not about necessarily getting a high cash flow today. It's about getting better cash flow in 2 to 3 years.
All right. Okay. So now let's talk about any other numbers that may come into our analysis. How do you look at future projections for either for appreciation or for rent growth or for, those kind of numbers? Do you put that into your analysis and say, well, today it's not really, you know, maybe breaking even today, but I know eventually rents go up, appreciation goes up generally. How should I factor that into my analysis?
Sure. So the way I factor it in is as follows. Appreciation, traditionally, over the last 60 years in real estate, is typically is about 5% per year.
That's a pretty good return. You know, it's a pretty decent number, steady.
Nothing. It's not exactly super exciting. Neither is it super low, but consistently real estate has performed at about 5% year over year. Okay. Now, obviously you have your booms, you have your busts, but average that over a long term. Real estate is a very long term game investment. You know, you're not doing it for, you know, it's not a short term thing. Okay. The whole point is long term. So over the long term, you can expect that your property will appreciate 5%. Okay. So yes, I put in about 5% for appreciation. I also put into my projections 5% for rent increases year over year. Now, I understand that in the last couple of years, rents have gone into double digit, whether it's teens or whether it's 20 to 30% in some markets that rents have gone up over the last few years. Again, you don't have to be so aggressive, right? It's a question to you of how aggressive you want to be. But when analyzing a deal, I would say expect rents to go up also another 5% per year. Okay. So you've got 5% appreciation. You've got rents going up by 5%. Now, property taxes and insurance also increase every year. They don't necessarily increase as high as 5%, but they do increase. So you need to have some expectation of it. 2-3% per year for insurance costs and property taxes. Okay. Now, I'm not asking anybody here to do all of this in their head or on a napkin. Again, download the spreadsheet, right? MearsGroupLLC.com/underwriter. You download the spreadsheet, plug the numbers in there. Okay. You don't have to do it. There's an, in fact, if you scroll down, there's going to be a 5-year projection of what's going to happen with cash flow. And then if you go down further, there's going to be a 5-year projection of what kind of internal, what kind of rate of return you can expect, right? So if you had the hold the property for 5 years, right? For 5 years, there's some amount of cash flow. We went over this and, you know, I think it's a good place to go over the 5 quadrants where real estate makes you money.
Where do we find the Excel spreadsheet so they can analyze the deals? I want to post it in the chat.
Sure. MearsGroupLLC.com. So MearsGroupLLC.com/underwriter. Okay.
Okay.
And, you know, it's actually a combined underwriter. It has a fix and flip analysis in it and underwriting, as well as buy and hold and refinance. So there's a tab at the bottom that's going to say BH inputs. So that's your buy and hold inputs tab. And that's where all of the analysis happens. And there's a 5-year projection there as well. So 5 quadrants. There's cash flow. So as we discussed, there's rent coming in, there's expenses going out, and at the end of it, there's either positive cash flow or negative cash flow. If there's negative cash flow, just be aware that you are essentially subsidizing the building and the tenants in it. So you really want the cash flow to be at least neutral, right? Zeroed or positive. You want some kind of positive cash flow left over. Quadrant number 2 is mortgage pay down. So if you have debt on it, right? You have a mortgage. Every single month, part of the payment is pay down of the principal. Then number 3, so that, and that over, you know, over the years, right? Every year, every month, a little bit gets paid off, gets paid off, gets paid off. Then you have appreciation, as we discussed, right? So every year, this property is going to go up by, let's say, roughly 5% in value. Then we have something called depreciation. Depreciation is the wear and tear on the building being deducted from income taxes. Right. It depends on how your taxes are being done, but it flows through and it gets deducted from your income tax. So it's a tax savings. Okay. It's not income per se. It's a tax savings. So it reduces the money being spent. And then the 5th quadrant, the 5th place where real estate works for you is inflation hedge. So as inflation goes up, right? What we're having today, right? We have high inflation. And so as you know, the value of the property, it's not that the value increases, but it maintains its place relative to the money supply, right? The value has retained. So now, if you went, you know, if we all went to the store and, you know, we used to pay $2 for a loaf of bread and today we're paying $4 for a loaf of bread, right? Because of the supply of money, you know, the money that's available in the supply. Well, guess what? Same thing with the house. The house used to be $100,000. Now it's $200,000. It's not that it's increased in value because of appreciation. It's increased in value because of inflation. It's maintained its place. Okay. So your money is protected that way. So these are the 5 ways that real estate pays you. And if you look at the spreadsheet at the bottom of it, you're going to have the cash flow, appreciation, and the mortgage pay down calculated into the returns. And it's a 5-year projection. So at the end of 5 years, there's going to be some kind of cash flow, right? You've been increasing rents every year. At the end of 5 years, there's going to be mortgage pay down for those 5 years. A little bit was paid every single month. And there's going to be some appreciation over those 5 years. So those 3 numbers put together are some kind of return on the investment. And then divided by 5, you're going to get your annual return. annualized return. Okay. So if way back when your down payment on a property was, let's just for rough numbers, was $50,000. And over the course of, over the course of 5 years, you have earned, you've brought in $100,000. So 50 of it covers the initial input investment. Now you have an additional $50,000 on top of it, right? So,
okay.
Again, this is what the spreadsheet is for, right? You don't have to do this in your head. You don't have to do it on a paper napkin. The work's been done. Just plug the numbers into the spreadsheet. I'm just explaining where they come from. Now, in it, all of the formulas are open, right? So, our viewers are welcome to modify it as they see fit for their own purposes, right? If you're in a market that has 6% management instead of 10, great. If you're in a market that has more snowfall than, other markets like Michigan, right? Plug in a higher number for landscaping then because of it. Whatever it is, adjust it how you need to adjust it.
All right. So Mark, that's a good explanation of analysis. Let's go to some lessons learned from our own experience on analyzing deals and purchasing. I'll start with me. I know one mistake I've made is just not having enough reserves there in the bank in case of anything happening. Because, you might calculate, 10% for repairs, 10% for vacancy. But what if that 10% that you budgeted annually hits in the first month or it hits in the second month and you haven't yet saved all of that cash from your income there? So for me, I always include an additional, 2 or 3 months worth of expenses now, just to make sure, if these things happen in the early part of the year, I'm covered. So that's one thing that, bit me in the ass early on. What about you? Any lessons learned over the years in terms of analyzing and investing?
I don't trust the agents and their numbers. And one of the biggest things was, I'm just thinking back on it. The early lessons I had in the Poconos were I had no idea about how to hire people or how to have management. That's what bit us in the ass. It was the fact that we had to be the ones to go up there and let people in and out of the property, as we're the ones that were doing the laundry and cleaning up. It wasn't worth it. So the lesson learned was very much that you need to have management in place. Okay. Now with management, here's, golden tidbit. Even if you're going to self-manage, never tell the people you're the owner. Never let the tenants know you're the owner. You're just the manager. Even if you're going to buy, for example, right, there's great programs available through conventional mortgages like HUD, or FHA, where you can live in a property, right? You can buy a multifamily property, put very little down, as long as you occupy one of the units. So the kind of the best, whatever, house hack, I think the term would be for this is you buy a 4-unit property, you live in one of the units, and you rent out the other three. Great. Best financing available. The one thing I would suggest is you don't tell the other tenants that you're the owner living in the property, because then they're coming to you with everything. No, you're just another tenant and somebody else is managing, or even if you're managing it while you're living there, you're not the owner. You're just the guy living there and taking care of the property. So that there's somebody else, right? Third party authority. So you don't want the tenants, everybody else to know who the owner is. Okay. That's I think a big thing. We had a tenant who, found out what my address was and, ended up sending mail to our house where I have my kids. That's just not acceptable, basically. Yeah.
Separating yourself from the investment and putting those, walls, I guess, or you know, shields in place so that, you know,
correct,
you're not directly responsible for, even though you are directly responsible for, but
correct,
they know there's a process to go through and it's not correct necessarily through you.
Right. So, it's the LLC, right? The asset is inside of an LLC. There's a business built around it. Whatever's supposed to happen will happen. But, you know, sending stuff to my own house was not cool, right, to put it mildly. And so what bit me in the ass? It's not knowing how to hire people initially and doing everything ourselves. Being the technicians in our business was pretty much what bit us in the ass. In terms of analysis, you know, in terms of actual numbers and analysis, I can't say it's not that I'm so great. It's just, I've run numbers on so much and I'm so conservative. Like, I'm so cautious and conservative with how I buy that, you know, we've just had reserves. I haven't had to, dip into it necessarily. Actually, no, here's a story. And this isn't our properties in Connecticut. I have rentals elsewhere. And the manager there kept sending me payments while we were going negative. So for whatever reason, I was getting distributions and I missed in the statement that we were negative, even though I was getting distributions. It's really strange that I got distributions while not having enough to cover the property. And so I ended up having to have a capital call there because we burned through, you know, we weren't getting enough rent. Then we stopped getting rent because of vacancy. And then there were no reserves left over. Essentially, we burned through the reserves just to pay the mortgage. And then I had to, you know, raise capital. So I would suggest, but that's already ownership. That's not so much, the initial
purchase.
Correct.
Right. Okay, Mark, coming up on the hour mark here. I think this has been a good episode. We talked about how to analyze the deal, the income, the expenses that go into analyzing and making sure that a deal works before putting in an offer on it. So I want to encourage our viewers to check out this link, MearsGroupLLC.com, underwriter. There you'll get the spreadsheet where you can plug in your numbers and find out if a deal is a deal or not. Yep. And you know, this should really help you in whether you're first time, whether you're experienced. It's always good to run your numbers and make sure that you know what you're getting into. So thanks a lot, Mark, for joining us at this episode. I'm sure we'll hook up again on another episode. We have so much more to talk about. And we're gonna close out for now. But I want to thank everyone for joining us and tune in again for the next episode. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.